Hello and welcome to episode 129 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston. We meet again. The nights are definitely wintry, and it's that time of year where you're just kind of waiting for the Christmas thing to happen really now, isn't it? How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And as you say, the nights are definitely dark in as much as it gets dark by about 4 o'clock. It does make you realise that the Christmas thing is almost upon us. And as somebody who has spent more than his fair share of time in airports in the last few weeks, I can assure you that for airports, Christmas started before Halloween. And the Christmas trees and decorations and festive selling of perfumes and etc. has been going for quite some time.
Oh, it's relentless, isn't it? Yeah, we went into Kingston upon Thames Town Centre on Saturday, and yeah, the shops are in full Christmas swing. But you still get that sort of sensation that many of the big chains will come out of this teetering on a knife edge as to whether they stay in business or not.
Well, as always, you know, retail is, and most retailers live on a pretty much hand to
wing and a prayer existence.
That's right. Yeah. And they, and this is the time of year, of course, where they manage to push themselves into the black, if possible. And that's why every time there's a... I remember talking to a guy I know who was a retail, he's still a retail CIO, and he was at, I think he was at Selfridges at the time. But anyway, I asked him how his Christmas was, and he just said it was awful, because Christmas, you know, up to Christmas, and then Boxing Day, when the online sales happened, all he did was spend his time sitting in the toilet waiting for the phone to ring, because if their website goes down on Boxing Day, that's pretty much it. You know, they can wipe off all the profits for the year because they haven't managed to scoop up those Boxing Day sales. I thought that was a few years ago. Maybe Boxing Day sales aren't the same thing anymore, but yeah, it was. It's a pretty scary time.
It is. I can't think of any other sector where the seasonality of the way in which they do business is quite as extreme as it is for retail.
Yeah, I guess there are. You know, the sort of holidays and travel, I suppose, is one, and everything that goes into things like shopping and retail and all the factories that produce Christmas produce or produce particular types of things. You know, there's lots of stuff that we buy that's kind of seasonal. I think there's quite a lot of manufacturing, especially food manufacturing, that goes into it. So probably more than we realise. I remember there was a conversation somebody was having about Boots. I think it was Boots. Yes, Boots. And they do this thing every year where they do 3-for-2 sales, right? And you've seen the things. You go in and they're selling boxes of perfume for 3-for-2 and all this kind of thing. So they said this year they weren't going to do it. And then apparently the story goes that they said they weren't going to do it. And then Tesco or Asda or Sainsbury's or somebody decided that they were going to do it. And then everybody was going there and nobody was going to Boots. Then Boots suddenly decided they were going to do it again. And it seems to me, I think this is highly unlikely, because these things aren't decided the week before Christmas, right? Are they? In terms of all the promotional stuff, all of the stickers and all the cartons and all of the stuff that gets ordered, this stuff isn't decided. It's decided a long time ago. So either Boots genuinely did decide not to do it, but somehow managed to turn it around, or it was all some kind of subterfuge to remind people about it, or it was just a terrible bit of, or maybe they didn't think they were going to be able to do it because they had some sort of supply chain issue, but then they figured that they could. But it just seems weird and odd that people could think that a massive chain like that could turn in 6 months the week before Christmas. I don't see it.
No, I think anything of that sort of size and scale to be able to change quickly is pretty much an impossibility. And the lead times, I remember I worked, one of my, between exams when I was at school jobs, was working in a screen printing factory that did point of sale material for people like Dixon's and that sort of stuff. We were printing Christmas stuff in July. It was some years ago, but nonetheless, you know, the lead time of being able to get all that stuff in place is phenomenal.
Were you having to get all the letters out of the little cases and arrange them on the press?
Well, as you know, I was there with my quill. It was fine. We didn't actually have printing. Any particular highlights of the week that's just gone for you?
Oh, the week that's just gone. Right, okay. So, no. Yes, I was down in London on last week, and that was quite nice. And I went down to see a few people, and that was really good. And then today I was in Paris, which was exciting, but fairly tiring, as I was up early this morning on the aeroplane, and now I've just got back from an aeroplane, so you catch me. You know, I'm still not adjusted from the European time. Once you set me to European time, it takes 24 hours for that clock to wind around. So, so it's kind of been a fairly busy week. What about you?
It's been a week of exploring a number of areas, including designing for mobile. Why do organisations still have an idea that mobile is some sort of secondary thing? I don't understand. And then
yes, I agree with that.
Well, but then also thinking that the answer to designing for mobile is responsive design. It's fascinating. So there's a few bits and bobs I've been doing, looking at work recently, and it's this idea that, will it work on mobile? Oh, it's responsive. Yeah, but a spreadsheet can be designed responsively so that it can be used on a mobile screen, but a spreadsheet on a mobile screen is still dire. It's dreadful. And actually, you need to think about the context about which somebody will use something on a mobile device and redesign how you present it as a result, not just make it able to be displayed smaller on a screen.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. If you call responsive design just the automatic resizing of stuff so it all manages to shimmy up together on a mobile screen, that's not what I call responsive design. But that's crap responsive design indeed. Absolutely. It's not genuine responsive design, really, is it? I mean, that's what you have to the point is, it has to rearrange itself and be the same site, but also be absolutely relevant to that screen estate and work as an experience. It can't just be...
And be guessing to do the sorts of things you might want to do when you're handling a mobile device rather than when you're sitting at a screen. It's years back, when I was working at Microsoft, I wrote an article called 7 Reasons to App, which is sort of along these lines as well, which is, why would you want to write an app rather than just an HTML web page that will perform well on a mobile device? And it's interesting, after probably about 8 years since I originally wrote the article, 7 years since I wrote the article, a number of the reasons why, things like really being able to handle location, you can do all that in the browser now. Being able to notify, you can do all that in the browser now. There's a couple that still remain that are still quite hard to do. Really using sensors within the device, I think, is still quite hard to do. You can use camera and you can use bits and bobs around geolocation, but you can't really get into powerful stuff around movement and what have you within web design. I think caching, so that I can look at the thing when I'm not connected to the network, is possible to
offline
do in a browser,
work,
but nobody designs it well. It's amazing how many apps, things like LinkedIn, where it will give me a notification when I get into a tube station, and then I'll go on to the underground again, lose connection. You click on the notification and it's gone to all the effort of giving me the data for the notification, but not enough for me to click through and find anything else about it at all. And there's loads of apps that work like that. Infuriates me.
Deep and enduring mystery of notification services, which are completely separate to everything else.
Madness.
And I completely agree with you. And I think I think I remember reading that, you know, the when you did it at the time, or certainly I read it since. And the reasons for having an app or not have definitely changed over the years. But was it who was it this week who said that people were looking for an app?
It was a bank. So it was somebody who was making it. They were saying, why would you need an app? This is a conversation that took place on the WhatsApp group. Yeah, get in touch with us in Twitter if you want to join it. But they were saying about how they heard of people who were for banking, if there wasn't an app there, they wouldn't move to that bank. And some bank had actually tried this, and they'd find out that if they didn't have an app in the marketplaces, then people, their sign-up rate for new customers were dropping. And that, I think, is an interesting case. The other case that I think is still really interesting is the idea that there's a load of psychology around the concepts of reciprocity. If I give you something, you will subconsciously feel duty-bound to give me something back. And this is how most marketing works, how free offers work. It's how the freemium model for software, to a great extent,
works. Is this how this podcast works, Matt?
It is, yes.
Is somebody going to give something back one day?
Yeah, we are working on the Patreon scheme. It's coming soon, people. It's coming soon. The idea that you can give an app and it is a gift and it is a thing that is more tangible than giving a link to a website. And I think there is still something in that, that an app has a sense of it being a thing that a website doesn't. And it's very ethereal, but I think that there is still value in being able to give an app if it's useful and of value. But it's part of the debate we've got going at RHP at the moment. And should we start to think about apps for our customers? And I'm still generally of the view that it's probably not worth it, because actually we can do everything that we need to within the browser.
Mm. And you can sometimes, of course, you can dress things up as an app sometimes, and that will be,
yeah,
you know, that will be enough for some people, because that's the way they've learned how to use a mobile phone, right? And they want a button on the phone they can press that says, this is how I get to that thing. So strange enough, we are now at the stage where we're having to, just as we used to have to do that with text messaging, for example, we're having to cater for people's previously learned behaviours around mobile. Even though things have moved on a bit, we have to still retroactively do things in the way that they used to be done as well. You know, it's kind of a backward compatibility with people.
Yes, and there's a lot of those behaviours that get learned. And this, I always come back to, still so many people will send a text message if they're running late for a meeting, even though they won't do it for anything else now. And it's a useless form of communication because it's not delivered in a way that you can guarantee the delivery time. But nonetheless,
I disagree.
Anyway. G'day, the joys of mobile. This week, it's a purist edition. It's one for the old school listener. It's just you and me gassing away. What are we talking about this week, Mr. West?
We're going to talk about, as we promised a couple of weeks ago, because the election was called, we promised that we were going to talk about any policy that came up around tech, and we were going to do a bit of an exploration of those policies. Well, last week was a bit quiet, but this week we've got a doozy.
Yeah, well, we've got twozy. So,
well,
two
we have
of them.
Indeed. We have,
yeah,
got
indeed.
Two. But yeah, we've got, you know, the highly controversial, somewhat, I think, what's the word I'm looking for? Somewhat similar. You know, I've heard this before, kind of nationalisation of OpenReach.
Wonder where you might have heard that before.
Yeah.
Oh, free, here.
Free broadband to every home, etc. Policy from Labour, and we also have some sort of tech wibbling from other elsewhere. So let's talk about that.
Let's crack on. So the first of the tech election watch things we're going to look at this week came from the man who doesn't quite know how many A's he should have in his name, Dominic Raab, and he apparently, when being interviewed on Andrew Marr's show at the weekend, gave some indications that the way in which organisations should deal with potential skill shortages coming up should be through innovation. So to quote, he said, "We want to be able to plug gaps in specific areas, whether it's the NHS or whether it's elsewhere. But what you don't want to do is encourage over-reliance on cheap labour from abroad, which has a depressing effect on wages in this country." Just a moment just to note that actually there's very little evidence that that's the case. Actually, the way to deal with that for those sectors that are concerned is to invest in innovation to drive up the productivity of those sectors rather than just engage in this artificial reliance on cheap labour from abroad. That's better for this country, for businesses and also workers. What do you make of the former lawyer's views?
Well, I think from my point of view, it's one of those statements which is hard to argue with at a very high level. And as much as I'm going to make a point here about all of these different political promises that you know, we are going to try and be even-handed. And I've got no real love for any of the people making any of these claims. So if I'm going to be critical, then it's probably going to be even-handed. But personally, I think Raab is an odious human being, and I don't really want to listen to him and didn't say anything. But you can't argue with the fact, and I cannot argue with it as somebody who has worked in IT in organisations all my career, what I have been doing often is trying to improve productivity by by innovating or putting in new technology, right? So that is saying to somebody, oh dear me, that's a really tedious job that you're taking a day over. Let's put some technology in so you can take 20 minutes over it, and then you can spend an hour checking it and making sure that everything's fine. And then you go on with your day. So that to me is a productivity boost. And yes, you can boost productivity with tech, with innovation. It's meat and drink of our industry, if you call our industry IT. So
as an aspiration.
I agree, absolutely, absolutely. But also as a practical outcome, right? It's absolutely true. If you can, and again, I come back to my definition of IT that I always use, which is it is about getting better information to people more in a more timely way so they can make more, they can make better decisions quickly, right? More quickly. If you can make a faster decision, you're better off. And if you can make a better decision, you're better off by definition. And the better informed you are, the faster, the less you have to work on poor information. That's what IT really does. So if you could do that, fantastic. Yes, you can improve productivity because you're going to order fewer of the wrong things, or you're going to employ the right number of people to do this job, or you're going to turn up at the right place at the right time with the right tools and the right instructions to do the job that you need to do, right? So that's all about, for me, productivity. And yes, absolutely, that's all fine. I would say, though, to use it as a kind of glib cover-all for, oh, well, yes, you're telling me about a problem that we're just creating for everybody by one policy or another, but if only people were to think about this, it's just a bit harder, I'm sure the problem would go away. I think it's a load of old crap. But it's, unfortunately, that's a typical government statement, isn't it? It's just to say, well, tech will solve it if only we cross our fingers and hope hard enough.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. The example I'm reading from the coverage of this in The Independent, and the example that he went on to use was the housing industry, where there was room for innovation to plug skills shortages. Rob said, the nature of the housing market has changed with modular methods of construction. There are innovative ways of building that don't rely on the same volume of cheap labour from abroad, which boosts the housing industry and also for workers in this country changes the nature of what it's like to work in the construction industry, from working on sites in the cold through thick and thin to working in factories with greater career progress. It's a fascinating sort of leap of logic, but also I think is symptomatic of actually this, and this is a problem that I think has been in British government actually since the post-war period, and since the immediate time after the Second World War, and the archetypal example was the amount of investment that went into the coal mining industry, which has kind of became the formation of socio-technical thinking, because they went out and said, we need technology. We haven't invested in our coal mines since the 1930s, 1920s even. And so we need to find the best technology in the world. And if we implement that best technology, we will have better, more productive coal mines. And so they found the technology, they brought it in from the United States. It involved massive mechanization and automation. They installed it and productivity fell off a cliff. And it was because it isn't as simple as just saying, there's a solution, implement that, and you will magically get productivity gains. Because it's not just about the technology. These are about people and working practice and customer expectations and regulation and established ways of working that need to be unpicked and. And if you take modular housing as an example, there's no doubt that modular housing can lead to more efficient, effective ways of being able to do the construction of the house on site. There's a good friend of mine who has a modular house that was built for him, interestingly, in Germany, so that wouldn't do much for British workers, that's another story. And it took him 2 weeks from the laying of the concrete foundations to the construction and finish of the outside waterproofed, sealed of the house. It took him 7 years to be able to get to the point of having all the permissions in place to be able to do that. The productivity issue with him building his house was not about the building of the house. And I think it's a silly little example, but it's exactly that kind of thing, that this idea that just technology will make things more productive is possibly the snake oil that the IT industry has been selling for many years, but it's just too simplistic.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because you've got somebody who's a non-expert, like like Rab, talking about things that he doesn't really understand, but has seen a brilliant example, you know, some presentation about 3D buildings or something, concrete 3D printing, or modular buildings, and thinks, you know, oh, that would be fantastic for the workers to live in. I mean, clearly he wouldn't live in a house like that himself, but it would be fantastic for the little people. It's just nonsense. It's stupidity. And I it's an easy answer, and I'm afraid just grasping for easy answers when you've got a significant problem is not really an answer at all. And is it even a tech answer? I don't think so. It's like, you know, what are we going to do about the fact that we've got no sales? Well, do you know what? CRM's rubbish. Let's buy another CRM system. No, that'll sort it. That never fails.
And, of course, the other interesting thing, if you look at the patterns of moving towards self-employment, and that's a number of something like 7% rely in the UK now on the kind of Uber-type model with technology distributing small amounts of work. There's a huge number of people. And that actually what's happened there is technology has created vast swathes of very unproductive work. Because what the technology has done is to put in a mechanism in the middle for being able to package up very small amounts of relatively low-skilled work to whoever is available at the time. And we've now got hugely not productive, particularly useful work going on, but it's at scale, massively subsidised by tech companies who are being funded for their exit price not to be able to make profitable businesses. So tech innovation in that instance, a load of, you know, delivery people and Uber drivers and task rabbit monkeys, that's not right. Is that really productivity? No, that's just causing vast amounts of work.
Yeah, it's true. And I think there are lots of examples of, I guess, jobs that have disappeared or things that have changed just because the way that people have, the way that they consume things or the way that people work has changed. And for example, the milkman has gone away, even though people still drink plenty of milk. Not many people get delivered to their door anymore because they're going to pick it up from the supermarket. Now, there was nothing really wrong with the fact that the milkman did the job. It's just the fact that the way that people decided to consume that product has changed. And is that more efficient now that people lug kilos of milk backwards and forwards from the supermarkets out of town in their cars? Or was it more efficient back in the day when the milkman would trundle up in his little electric car? I don't know. But it's, you can't.
It was a lack of flat whites, because the thing is, if you position it as a subscription based milk service using electric vehicles for last mile delivery, that sounds like it's straight out of Hoxton.
Yeah, you definitely get seed funding for that, wouldn't you?
Anyway, so there we go. That's our first little trawl into the world of politics. Of course, the manifestos start getting published next week, so we're going to have loads of fodder. But
super.
Yeah, let's get on to number two.
So the second, and probably more contentious, or certainly the one that's gained most publicity of our tech policies of the week, is this announcement by the Labour Party that they're going to provide free broadband to the whole country. And it's going to cover the whole country completely, and they're going to do that by nationalising BT or parts of BT, and they're going to tax the tech giants in order to make it work. What do you know about this, Matt?
That's pretty much it in terms of the sort of vague election pledge from the Labour Party, or Visionary, as they'd like to have it known as, which they priced at £20 billion. Obviously, the industry is up in arms because it's obviously a terrible idea. But what it's got me thinking, I'm not sure whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. I can see it being argued either way. But I think there's a couple of things that we should consider before coming up with a conclusion about whether it's a good idea or a bad idea. The first thing we should consider is there is a natural tendency to communications platforms to become monopolies. If you look at where we're at with the internet at the moment, to all intents and purposes, Google is the search engine monopoly. To all intents and purposes, Facebook is the monopoly of non-work-based social networks. To all intents and purposes, LinkedIn is the monopoly of work-based networks. To all intents and purposes, Microsoft Office 365 is the monopoly for office productivity and collaboration platforms. You know, the list goes on. There's some enterprise segments which are far less monopoly or duopoly. So things like CRM actually is very fragmented still. I'm always amazed when Salesforce put out marketing blurb about how they've got 27% of the market and then have a graph that shows you how the rest is split. And there's like nine players that are all worthy of being on a graph in a newspaper ad. That's another story. But if you look at the history of, say, the London Underground, it started off as a private venture. They were useless and they produced a bunch of competitive things that were competing with each other over the same area and then weren't giving coverage elsewhere. The whole thing is an utter mess and it had to be bailed out in the 30s because it was all going bust. And it was mostly American money that came in to build it and it was a disaster. It wasn't until it was brought into state ownership and then rationalised and there's some central planning that it kind of made any sort of sense. And realistically, in the UK at the moment, for telecoms, there is only one telecoms provider nationally. Yes, we've got Virgin Media, which is the cobbling together of all of those itty-bitty little cable services that set up in the 80s and 90s. But the only company that is guaranteed to deliver to more or less every home is BT, and they've had to ring fence the bit that provides the network Openreach because it's a monopoly, in the same way that National Rail has been ring fenced and actually has been renationalised because it is a natural monopoly. And so at one level, at least the, you know, the nationalisation of Openreach, which we have sort of talked about on the show before, I don't think is a necessarily stupid idea because it can't be run as a competitive thing. And private sector companies running things that are monopolies, generally, effectively, they become state-run anyway because they're so regulated. And they're state-run, but just they're ineffectual, useless things. So why not just take full ownership? That's the one bit of it. The other side, though, is I think we need a national debate. And this is broader than just technology, but I think this is it's a good example of it. A national debate about what are the things the state should provide, what are the things that should be paid for on the basis of ability to pay, and what are the things that should be paid for on the ability to consume or the necessity to consume. So we have a weird setup at the moment. The National Health Service, which is a thing that I think should be treasured, although is very dysfunctional because it's so big, is something that's free at the point of delivery. So you get free NHS care as long as you pay your taxes and all the rest, although there's no real condition there. Television still is something that is taxed on the basis of a flat rate. It's a poll tax, basically, and that's probably anachronistic, but if we got rid of it, we'd kill the BBC, and I think that would be a bad thing, although I have a vested interest because of my family history of the BBC. Libraries are totally free at the point of use. Food... you just have to have the money to buy it, and if you don't have the money, you go hungry. So we're in a state at the moment where libraries are free, but food for the hungry isn't. And then people go, yeah, but broadband being free is a ludicrous idea. There's no rationality to anything that we provide as state-run services or not these days. It's crackers. And actually, I think what this, for me, more than anything says is that we really do need to have a long sit-down about it, because I don't believe that the cost of providing broadband to every home, which you have to do, because if you're going to provide it to every home and then not actually deliver it to people, that's a massive amount of investment that you then not use. It's never going to happen if you just do it on the basis of one by one we'll provide fibre to the home when you order it. Can't work like that. So you've got to provide it. Once you've provided it, you might as well give it away for free anyway, because it's there, and the incremental cost of turning another house on is going to be zip. So there you go. That's my thoughts.
Well, I think there's a lot to be said for those thoughts, Matt, in as much as, so even though the, you know, you've seen that kind of spoof Maslow's hierarchy where somebody's written Wi-Fi
at the bottom. Right? Yeah.
And that's, at the end of the day, broadband is not a bit the same as being warm, safe and dry, which is pretty much the fundamental needs of people.
Although you can't claim universal credit without using the internet.
Ah, well, and that's a very important point. So, and that's really what I was coming to. So you've got your fundamental needs, and then you've got things like food and energy, so food and heating. Well, as you say, if you don't have the money to pay for your heating, if you don't have money to pay for food, then you're not going to get any. Now, although there are benefits and the state provides for a certain amount of that. Water is similarly charged for and is run in England, at least by private companies. And I've got a suspicion that maybe Openreach was privatised in the same way that the water companies were back in the 80s, when privatisation was the answer and the market was going to drive up quality and standards. The idea that you can take something like water, which falls from the sky, and we all produce a great deal of it that's contaminated, and therefore it has to be cleaned up and it has to be sorted out, and people need to have it in their homes. The fact that the idea that you can make a profit out of that is preposterous, really. So, but it was privatised anyway, and I think Openreach was probably privatised in the same way, as you say, because it was a national provision, it was infrastructure, the country had invested in.
It was also a very different era, of course. So when it was privatised in the early 80s, because that was one of the early ones, wasn't it, with the whole...
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Busby campaign and all of that, and...
Well, no, Busby was in the 70s. It wasn't Sid, was it? It was Gas. But anyway, no.
Yeah, but it was early, but it was also purely telephones when it was privatised.
Well, indeed. And we've got a situation that... So take that aside, right? Absolutely, there's a kind of a difference between broadband and food and water and things like that. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't be concentrating on broadband, and maybe Labour shouldn't be concentrating on providing people with digital access when there's other things that may be more important that need to be addressed for free. And I say free with my finger quotes going, because, of course, first of all, every pedant will go, well, of course, it's not for free because the taxpayer has to pay. Well, yes, obviously, you know, that's a fact. There's no such thing as a free lunch. There's also the thing, well, what's it going to cost? Well, of course, if it's an asset purchase, it's not necessarily a cost. You're buying, if you nationalise an industry, as long as you don't overpay for it, and as long as you look after it, you haven't lost your money, you've just invested in an asset. But to your point, Matt, there's a massive amount of research that shows that if you do not have access to the internet, you are significantly disadvantaged compared to those that do. And of course, you're not just going to have access to the internet. You need to have a computer or some device at which to make it work, and you need the skills and the understanding in order to do it. But if you want to get a better deal for your insurance or your gas or your whatever, you need to be online, because people are charging less for online business because it costs less to prosecute. If you want to claim certain benefits, as you say, you need to be online. If you want to be able to manage your life in a way that makes sense, if you want to apply for a job, if you want to set up a power of attorney, whatever it might be, and use lots of government services, you will do a far better job of it online. It will cost you less, and you'll be quicker than you will if you're not online. And therefore, those digitally excluded people, we need to address that somehow. And I see a progressive force in this idea. I do think there's a massive amount of things that have got to be figured out, though. I don't think that they've thought it through much beyond the initial kind of look at the figures from the government's own review, where it said, oh, look, if we do this and we try and push out this provision of broadband all the way around the country, and we do it in a competitive way, it'll cost 32 billion. If we do it in a nationalised way, it'll cost 20 billion, because the cost of competition actually push the whole thing up. Now, if you're in Labour, you see that and you think, oh, fantastic, look, we get what one thing, which is we get fibre to every home or broadband to every home, and we get nationalised industry. It's like, we like that as well. It's perfect. We'll have a bit of that. Then you get to people like John McDonnell talking about, well, we're only going to privatise Openreach and a few other bits of BT. Seems to be a bit confused as to what exactly they would privatise.
Well, no, you'd leave global services well alone, let's be honest.
Let them have that. Let them keep it. And also talking about talking to Virgin and TalkTalk as other service providers without really addressing the fact that they're very different, actually, TalkTalk and Virgin. And Virgin have their own cable. So even if you did privatise Openreach, you don't privatise Virgin. So you haven't got a monopoly in that sense. And are you really suggesting that you're going to have a government ISP, which is going to be the the provider, or are you going to leave that to other agencies, whether they be the private sector or whether you have some sort of community interest company or something like that going on to provide the service connecting back to this nationalised fibre. It's, I think the actual policy is really, really confused and doesn't really bear scrutiny. Having said that, I don't disagree that nationalising Openreach is necessarily a bad idea like you. But I also think that if you look at what the Conservatives said, it wasn't so long ago Boris Johnson was promising fibre to every home and gigabit broadband to every home.
Yeah.
Right? And then as you look at what they started to talk about, this is only a few months ago, Boris Johnson was saying we're going to provide gigabit broadband to every home without really specifying what he meant by gigabit broadband. And now, mainly because he probably heard the word somewhere, maybe from Ms. Akuri, and decided to try it out. And now we're talking about, the last I saw them talking about was gigabit capable broadband, which seems to lower the bar somewhat. So I think everybody is kind of playing with words a little bit around this, and they're probably making up as they go along. The question is does the intention work, and is it feasible? And I see a lot of the knee-jerk reaction to this policy saying, well, it's impossible. And of course, here goes Labour again, promising the earth and spending money we haven't got. When actually, £20 billion isn't that much money in the grand scheme of things. It's not at all a lot of money if you get an asset at the end of it, which is worth, and you've invested in national infrastructure. And it's not really dramatically different from what many countries do with their infrastructure. So I don't really think it's undeliverable. And a lot of the people who are saying it's undeliverable are the same people saying that Brexit, it should be easy. And why don't we just get it done? And which I find slightly ironic.
If you look at what's happened with things like smart metering, where you allow regulation to be able to determine a technology change that is affecting into every household, you'll see what happens if you leave it to the private sector. Smart metering is an utter disaster and is never going to deliver, and it was probably ill thought through in the first place, and then it just got worse. But if it's serious about being able to say, no, we're going to put fibre to every home, because that's the step change. Fibre to cabinet gives you better broadband, but it's not actually significantly better. And we're now, running at about 40 meg, if you're lucky, if you're on a BT-based service. Maybe you get up to 100 meg before contention if you're on Virgin. But that's still not gigabit. And I know that people will say, well, what do you need gigabit for? There's a bit of a discussion about that earlier in the week on the WhatsApp channel. And what do you need gigabit for? Well, the answer is we don't know yet, because there isn't gigabit to the home, so therefore nobody's developing the services for it.
Yeah, exactly. That's a bit like Steve Jobs saying you can don't put more than 64 megabytes in the Apple or whatever it was, the original Apple IIe, the fact that the engineers made capacity for more memory because they knew they would need it. But why would you ever need a 100 meg hard drive? Why would you ever need a gigabyte of storage space? Why would you ever need a terabyte of storage space? Everybody, you'll always need this stuff. I think a valid question is around, well, what are you going to connect to it really? Because as we talked about earlier in this podcast, the fact that mobile is now, why is mobile a secondary form factor? Well, most people do connect by mobile, and there are more and more mobile devices that are either going to be connected via your Wi-Fi in your house, connected to your gigabit broadband, which is never going to run at gigabit speeds, by the way, on your Wi-Fi. Well, I say never, but it's unlikely to. Or you're going to be out and about. Now, so cabling up homes seems to me to be a bit 10 years ago, 5 years ago, when really we're going to be looking at 5G, hopefully. Now, using all this stuff to backhaul all that 5G provision from masts, absolutely, completely understand that, and absolutely, I go for that. But if you can get 5G working and the number of devices you can run on 5G with the capacity of 5G, actually, do you really need broadband into every home? Maybe not. Maybe you just need community 5G. Maybe you need different, to think about this differently. So again, I do think there's valid criticism of this, of both the Conservatives and the Labour Party's approach to fibre to every home, for example, as maybe being slightly rooted in previous tech. But then when I look at the energy industry and the way that we're talking about energy provision being managed in future, and the fact that probably all significant energy consuming devices are going to have to manage their own consumption in agreement and coordination with other devices in your home and in your area, we're going to end up with lots of devices talking to each other on the internet. And maybe we do need all this bandwidth, because it won't just be your computer and your DVD player and your, you know, internet-connected fridge that's connected to the network. That will be millions of things.
So one of the biggest challenges that we've got with the research work that we're doing around smart devices, sensors and whatever, in the management of housing stock, is that most of our houses, or many of our houses, we can't guarantee there's any network connectivity there. And yes, you can do it with various bits and bobs. And I saw somebody last week, there was a complicated thing with a network that wasn't a IP network, was lower power, but then could be connected via GSM to be able to do this, that and the other. And so there's a level of complexity there, which if only we had electric and network by default in every one of our properties, it just wouldn't be an issue. But we don't, so therefore it is. I think there's one other, as we've been talking, the other example that I think from history is an interesting parallel for this, and this won't be popular with many in this country because it's from France, but what they did, what France Telecom did with Minitel in the 70s, and actually by saying, no, you can have a telephone directory, or we'll give you this Minitel terminal, which is a kind of, for the older ones around our audience, if you don't remember Minitel, it was a bit like Prestel.
If you don't remember Minitel, you probably don't know what Prestel looked like either.
Well, I know,
it's like CFAX.
Part of the joke. It was CFAX, but on a device that was actually connected. And the interesting effect of that for France was that they had an incredible amount of commercial activity that developed around Minitel, because so many homes had this device in. The secondary impact of that was France was very slow to go onto the World Wide Web. And so they were a late adopter, because they were an early adopter first time around. And, and those echoes, I think, are fascinating. But there's possibly something about that, and that the, you know, positioning some of this. I think the challenge that Labour's got is basically that they've been so effectively labelled by their opposition as to what they are, that they couldn't possibly use a line. One of the things I always, certainly for the last few years, have been saying about why the NHS is so important is because it's a driver of innovation and a driver of entrepreneurship. Because if you don't have to worry about healthcare for you or your family, because it's provided free by the state at the point of use, you can take risks with not having a conventional job, which, if, you know, for the last 6 years, I couldn't have done what I've done for the last 6 years in the US, because I couldn't have afforded the healthcare which would come with work, but doesn't come if you work freelance. And it's a similar sort of thing to that. Actually, seeing this as a platform for government to be able to provide for growth and development in the economy, we do it with roads, why not with broadband?
Well, that's the world put to rights in terms of tech strategy for elections in this week, and we'll wait to see what comes out next week when the manifestos, I think, are due to appear. So, Matt, what's your plan for this week? What have you got coming up?
There's two interesting things, actually. First of all, the first of my wife's birthday celebrations coming up on Saturday night. So, Tim, if you're listening, I won't be joining you for a run. That's all I'm saying. And then on Thursday, it is the Leading Edge Forum exec forum in London, which I'm going along to, and I'm excited because I'm going to go and see them and see lots of people I know there, and there's some really interesting speakers and stuff. But I'm more excited because the cards, the playing cards, the Matrix game that I've been working on for them, the printed cards have arrived, and I'm going to get my hands on some, and I'm really excited to see what happens when an idea that I had a few months ago and then have bounced around and developed and had loads of people involved in creating it, actually to see it professionally printed and designed in my hands, I'm very, very excited for.
Excellent.
How about you?
Well, I've got a more of a busy week this week, in as much as I'm going down to London tomorrow, and I've got a meeting down near Heathrow, and then I'm going over to Denmark to see a customer over there. So I'll be there, and then I'm coming back on Wednesday, And then I'm prepping for the week after. And next week I'm going to a thing called the European CIO of the Year Awards in Barcelona. So it's a it's again another busy couple of weeks for me.
That sounds very exciting. Maybe one day I'll be a contender. Don't laugh.
How can you not be?
And the other thing is I've got another interview lined up, hopefully for Friday. So we'll be hopefully hearing from a digital sociologist, Lisa Maria Moretti, who I hopefully am going to do a recording for with on Friday. But we'll see. But there's going to be plenty more election stuff, I think, next week when the manifestos come out.
Indeed. So let's get on with it and see how we get on till then.
Excellent. Well, have a good one.
And you.
Thanks for listening. If you want to find out more, you can find us at wb40podcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at wb40podcast. You can also find us on all good podcasting platforms. Search for us, find us, subscribe, and why not leave us a review?